Thanks, everybody. I'm from Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia, and it's great to be here. You obviously have a great spirit in the spirit of 1848 group, and obviously a great progressive group. In our Public Health Association, we have a political economy of group that I think would be sort of equivalent to yours. What I'd like to talk about today, when I saw you were doing this session, is I've pulled together with some colleagues some thinking. My group at Flinders University do a lot of training, both undergraduate, postgraduate, but also training with the people who work in our local health services. And the focus of that is always about equity and social determinants of health. So I was also a commissioner on the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, and that really got me to think very closely about, well, what do we mean? What do we mean about training people in terms of social determinants? So I sort of want to talk about a bit about that, then talk about some of the knowledge, practice, wisdom, and research that we're bringing to this topic, looking at some of the barriers that we've identified in doing this work, and then looking at some of the things that have facilitated or helped effective learning. The commission, of course, was launched now 2 years ago by Margaret Chan, and she made the point that health inequity really is a matter of life or death. So that was a fairly strong statement from WHO, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with the framework that's formed the thinking behind the commission. And it's, of course, looking at that social position and the social, economic, and political context that I think is the real challenge when you're working with people in health fields who are typically working downstream at health services. How can you make that relevant to them? And I think that's the big challenge, and that's where a lot of the co-option and a lot of the other factors come into play. The basic logic, I think, though, does appeal to health workers, and the basic logic of the commission was, what good does it do to treat people's illnesses but to give them no choice? And I've added to that, or no control over the conditions that made them sick. So that really does appeal to health workers as a basic starting point. And I think the other important thing that the commission established, and I think Margaret Chan was getting at it here, is that it's really the social environment that's crucial. And while health services and lifestyle choices have a role, they are actually mediated by those social choices. And I think that's the really crucial thing. Well, of course, the Commission concluded that we needed to develop a workforce that is trained in the social determinants of health. And that sounds seductively easy, but I think in practice it's much more difficult. The sort of knowledge and practice wisdom that I bring to this is I've been teaching social determinants of health for longer than I care think, and have sort of codified a lot of that teaching in a book called The New Public Health, where I've tried to make social determinants relevant to health workers. We do a lot of action learning projects with practitioners and middle management to try and encourage them to think about, well, from within a health service, how can they do action on the social determinants of health equity? And we've also got, at the moment, from our National Health and Medical Research Council, a grant looking at the effectiveness of comprehensive primary health care. And I'm drawing on a little bit from the interviews with practitioners and managers. I think the four main areas of barriers I want to talk about is the big problem of individualism. The fact that most health services only focus on the tip of the iceberg, they don't go below the surface, that clearly initial training is highly curative for most health professionals, and the medical imagination still dominates, and that makes it very difficult, I think, to get a social message through. And of course, individualism leads to a strong belief in the primacy of individual behavior change. And I guess coming to America, I'm coming to the home of individualism. And I guess in the West, I'm at the frontier of the rugged individualist, I guess. And it certainly has been a very strong theme in political discourses in our countries. And of course, it holds that individuals are totally responsible for their actions and their consequences, including health. Ethically, it, of course, appeals to autonomy, but it is also the basis of neoliberalism and the form of capitalism that we're currently seeing in, certainly in both of our countries. It very easily leads to victim blaming, and it does inform policy. And I quote here from one of our politicians. This was our health minister, and here you can see He had a very strong belief in individual responsibility, and that really drove his health policies. So I think an important thing is trying to reveal those. I had a quick look and found a quote from your previous Secretary for State of Health and Welfare, and he knew why your health costs were going up. Nothing to do with any structural factors. It was because we don't take good care of ourselves. So, you know, you can see the power of that kind of ideology if we're not challenging that. The other thing that I think more and more is, you know, that very often most of our health policies are ignoring everything below the surface and only looking at the tip of the iceberg. And I've certainly found this metaphor very useful in working with people in health services when we're talking about what do we do? And this is an example when you're looking at mental illness, kind of ignoring all the structural determinants of people's responses, the way we organise society, how we organise work, play, distribute power, and looking at class and gender and so on. But of course, all those factors are having a very powerful impact, I think, on people. Just from our study of primary healthcare workers, you can see in some of these quotes, the one where the person's saying that their role is much more tied around to providing a specific service around a specific issue to a specific person or a specific population group. And that very much leads to that kind of pressure on people just to do that. And of course, the emphasis on clinical, and certainly we're finding in our health services that actual retreat from community development practices and more kind of community organising to this very rigid focus on the immediate lifestyle risk factors of chronic disease. And of course, the other two factors that I think we really have to remember very clearly is that so much of the initial training that our health professionals get, certainly in Australia, is on cure and rehabilitation, and they might be lucky if they get a few lectures on social determinants, but it doesn't really engage them. And certainly with the medical students, it's seen as a part of the curriculum they can pay quite a lot of lip service to. And really, the fact that the medical imagination has dominated so much, that really has been to the exclusion of the sociological imagination. And I would call very strongly for a reinstating of sociology into our teaching. Now, the Commission, of course, really recommended that educational institutes should both make social determinants part of medical training, but also importantly, I think, for non-medical professionals. And they also said for the general public, which I think is another challenge and in lots of ways might be easier, because I think in some ways people do have an understanding that their health is rooted in their everyday lives. So what will help then to develop a workforce that is trained in social determinants in the way that the Commission imagined? Well, first of all, it obviously has to be a comprehensive across-the-board approach, and I think there should be dedicated curriculum in all health sciences and what we call the determinant sector, so that might be people working in urban planning or people working in education. And it really should provide both what we call breadth and depth. We want to look at the breadth of the social determinants, but not just do it in a kind of way that leaves people skimming over the surface, but actually enable them to think about that. It's very clear, I think, that you have to address value issues directly and be very clear that social determinants, yes, evidence is important, but they're also, but all forms of our ideologies about health and medicine are actually driven by societal and personal ideologies, and they have a very strong political angle to them, which, of course, biomedicine often manages to cover and not make explicit. So one of the tasks is to make the ideologies underlying all the paradigms that are behind the teaching that we're doing. So that is developing a sociological imagination for health systems. And I find increasingly you really have to produce evidence that does challenge that individualism and therefore behaviorism, because it's so appealing. If only we tell people, you know, we help them to see that their behaviors are wrong, then we will be able to do something about it and completely shut out all the kind of mountain of evidence about the ways in which social determinants are affecting them. So I think it becomes very important to get as many case studies as possible that challenge that. We've also concluded that you're not going to get a workforce trained in social determinants till you get equity and social determinants in policy statements and in practice models in health departments and healthcare institutions. And very often those just aren't present. And I think it's very hard to work with people and say, well, you have to do work on social determinants, but there's no policy, no organisational mandate for that. So therefore, you know, the training can't be part of their everyday work till that happens. Now, as I said, discussion of the values, if you look at the Commission's report, it's really grounded in strong values that health is a human right, that empowerment is central. Also, a very important message that governments need to intervene for the collective good. I think that's one of the important values of the Commission. And, of course, that evidence isn't enough to assure action. You know, in these days of evidence-based medicine, there's this kind of pretense that if only we get enough evidence on social determinants, then when we'll take action. But it's very clear that this is really about values and what kind of society we want. And Michael Marmot's made that very clear when he launched the report, said social injustice is killing people on a grand scale, and that was very much part of, as commissioners, of the message that we wanted behind that. And I think one of the ways that we do this in teaching is by trying to draw on as many inspirational people as possible. And for me, Halfdan Mahler has always been one of those people. And you can see here that he says this is really about a battle for social and economic equity in the spirit of distributive justice. And I think trying to capture that kind of spirit to inspire people can be very important in this. Just briefly on the evidence, in Australia, our big health shame is the health of our Indigenous people whose health status is about 12 years behind the rest of Australians. Not surprisingly, Indigenous people smoke more. So if you think back to that previous health minister, what was his solution? You know, we have to have education campaigns to tell people not to smoke. But if we look at the social determinants of being an Indigenous non-smoker, the first is that you're most likely not to smoke if you haven't been arrested or put in prison in the past 5 years, a very powerful determinant. And of course, in Australia, we had a stolen generation where Indigenous children were removed from their families and placed with white families or in institutions. And if you haven't been removed, you're twice as likely to be a non-smoker, to never have smoked or to have quit. So very quickly, we're getting to the social determinants of smoking behaviour. And I think getting lots and lots of examples like that is absolutely crucial when you're working with health workers. I think also, as I said, we found you really need institutional support. So I think movements such as socially accountable medical schools, curriculum reviews, producing data, using health equity impact assessments formally. And as I said, I think organisational policies are essential. Now, one of the best policies I've seen on social determinants actually came from my own state back. It's depressing because it's sort of 20 years ago, but if you contrast what this health minister's saying when he launched a social health strategy for our state, you can see that that's very different to a policy that's driven by individualism. You know, this is really saying, well, it's not, you know, we shouldn't continue to exhort individuals to change their attitudes and lifestyles when in fact it's the environment that they live in. Now imagine if you're working as a health worker under that policy, how different it is to working under a health policy that's stressing individualism. So our action learning really stresses that we have to move beyond, you know, that you've all heard of the solid facts. We very often find people have a sort of list approach of, you know, tick off housing, tick off education, tick off work. And it's really about getting people to reflect on their practice, so working in communities, working with people onto one basis, and really stressing that whatever level you're working at in a health service, whether you're the receptionist who's the front line when people come in, or whether you're the chief executive, you can act to reproduce or you can act to challenge unequal power relationships. So making it very clear that that's what this work is about. You obviously have to build on people's experience and start with their passions and their strengths. We often find that if we're working with medical practitioners, it's better to start with care and compassion than using the word, say, social justice, because they go, oh, yeah, care and compassion, that's me. Social justice, no, that's not me. Jenny Poppe in the UK has written of the dangers of the lifestyle drift, and we think that's, you know, very quickly that people get to the lifestyle, even if they start with social determinants. So making that danger very clear, I think, is important. As we said, engaging people as part of their everyday work practice, but only doing that by gaining support from managers and organisations. So we'll never now just work with health workers as a group. We'll always go to their managers and say, this is what we're going to do. Are you going to support them? Because if you're not, there's not much point us doing our work. And then, you know, having the managers of the people that we're working with engage in think tanks about the barriers enablers that are faced by their staff in terms of equity, so that the staff themselves go back to a supportive environment, and we're not expecting them to be individual, you know, we're putting our own philosophy into practice. Just some examples from our study that we're doing of primary healthcare service commitment. We're trying to collect examples of equity, and we found that many of the services use data, so, and that's some of the services actually move their location in response to that, to more disadvantaged areas. They certainly have a whole range of priority access for groups with worse health, and it's very clear that community development strategies are the most effective there. We've got a number of examples of advocacy. For instance, an Aboriginal controlled health service we're working with in Alice Springs has been lobbying strongly to increase the unit price of alcohol. They've been successful in that, and in the first year there's been a reduction in murders, alcohol-related murders and violence in that community. And it's also about collecting examples of how people move beyond rhetoric on intersectoral work to real partnerships and documenting what that means in practice. So that's an example of one of our health centres in an area of disadvantage. The Central Australian Aboriginal Congress is a very strong advocate, and they've had a strong campaign on stopping violence and have worked very closely with the men in their community to produce a declaration of violence. And there is now a demonstrable decrease in violence, and that has involved looking at the kind of social determinants of male violence in terms of incarceration, alcohol, lack of housing, lack of culture, lack of access to land and traditional celebrations. So in conclusion, I think the key messages are that you need a multiple and prolonged strategy. It has to be across the whole landscape of health and health-related workforce. It's about engaging people in an authentic way that really makes sense to their practice, getting beyond the rhetoric. And it's about learning that's leading to organisational change and recognising that individual practice can only be effective within that organisational change, and recognising that both of those forms of change should be about transforming unequal social power relationships. So thank you very much.